All right, everyone. Thank you all for coming. So my name is Jose Alvarado. Right now I'm doing my postdoc at MIT, but I'll be presenting you mostly work that I've done in Amsterdam, where I did my PhD. My work was on active gels. Here on my cover slide, you sort of already see a depiction of an active gel. This is sort of my attempt to make a movie into a picture. So the movie is initially, you know, everything what you see in like black, purple, sort of homogeneously distributed, and then active forces contract the entire gel to a smaller square, which is in the later stages of the movie here in yellow. But don't worry, I'll show you the actual movies in a few slides. Before I begin, I'll thank the people that I've worked with. These are fantastic people, of course. This is my supervisor from the Netherlands. Her name is pronounced Geisha, very difficult to pronounce for some people. Geisha Kundering. And work together with the theory group also in Amsterdam, Fred McIntosh and his two wonderful postdocs, Misha and Abi. So before I begin with the actual talk, I'm going to make two little advertisements because you know, there's some other potentially very interesting things that I'd like to discuss with some of you guys about if you're interested. So please approach me after the talk if you're interested in either of these two advertisements. The first is another sort of sub-project from my PhD. It's not active matter, but it's still sort of relevant. Imagine you have a liquid crystal, and you know, you fill them in these sort of a two-dimensional liquid crystal, and you fill them in either a disk or a donut. And all you require is that the liquid crystal sort of aligns with the boundaries, and then you ask, what would you expect the pneumatic field director field to look like? And what we know already from continuum theory, that if you put a pneumatic liquid crystal in these kinds of boxes, here on the left in this disk, you can't accommodate the fact that all these guys are parallel everywhere to the wall. So what you eventually get are two defects in the sort of orientation. At the defects, you have liquid crystal molecules pointing in different directions. And these guys are sort of polarly apart from each other. We already know this. We also know that if instead of this kind of geometry, we have this kind of geometry, we have a hole in the middle, we don't need these defects because the liquid crystal can accommodate all the molecules aligning perfectly along the walls. Now, if you take the size of this inner hole and you take the limit as this inner hole goes to zero, you have this structure, and then only when you finally realize the ultimate limit do you get this structure. But of course, when you take this limit, you forget that you have to have the hole about the same size as your actual molecule. And so far, we don't know what to expect when this hole size is on the molecular scale. And I've done experiments that sort of answer this question. There have also been simulations. So if you want to find out what the answer to this question is, approach me after the talk. So much for the first advertisement. Second advertisement, I'm at MIT now, and although I'm a physicist, I'm now working in a mechanical engineering department. This is my PI right now, Pico Hosoe. And Pico, she's very interested in making small-scale fluid pumps. This turns out it's very difficult, you know, because you have low Reynolds numbers at very small length scales, and it turns out that pushing fluids is pretty difficult. So I'm curious as to try to find out, you know, alternative strategies to the ones she's been investigating so far that probably involve active matter or maybe some other things. But what really drew me to mechanical engineers in the first place, these are some silly ideas that I'm still, my postdoc is still in its diapers, you know, I'm still coming up with different ideas. But I think it'd be pretty cool to, you know, work together with engineers to come up with some sort of like, you know, programmable flux, you know, that, you know, you won't have like millions of particles, but at least you could have particles that you could control fully, and then you can start asking questions, you know, at least in an experimentally realizable system. You know, what if you can systematically tune, you know, the diffusional noise of a single particle, or you can give them, you know, sort of curved trajectories or whatever, or anything else, you can move them forward and backwards. So I'm thinking a lot about these questions, and I'd definitely love to chat with some of you guys about this. So please approach me about programmable flux. And something even further off, my PhD was in the cytoskeleton, and I'm wondering if there's a mechanical equivalent that you can build that sort of mimics active gels in a certain way, just with mechanical parts. I feel like I'm working with some of the best engineers I can think of, so I'm trying to see how feasible these ideas are. So please, input's very much appreciated. But now I'll get back into my actual talk. This is about actin filaments and myosin motors. Most of you may already be familiar with them. For those that aren't, actin filaments, they're long, they're semi-flexible filaments, and you can think of these as just like elastic railroad tracks along which these myosin molecules like to walk along. An individual myosin molecule, dimer, let's say, or a multimer, it composes of these two sort of rabbit ear-looking like domains that bind actin filaments and burn through ATP to move in one direction. And down here, you'll see a movie of taken with a fast AFM. I think it's experimentally pretty challenging, of a single myosin molecule. And you'll see that this guy will be walking in that direction along an actin filament. Yeah, I think he's moving. And well, maybe many of you also know that actin and myosin are the essential ingredients inside our muscles. They're the reason why we can lift a cup of coffee to our mouths. And perhaps you also know when you lift a cup of coffee to your mouth, something very important about actin and myosin is that when you lift something with your arm, it's these muscles that pull. But then if you want to put a cup of coffee back down on the table, what do you think happens to these muscles? Anyone know? No idea. Sorry?
You have another set of muscles which makes you happy.
Exactly, exactly. These muscles relax, they don't really do anything. And these muscles also pull, and that way you have a full range of motion. And something important about actin and myosin, they always exert contractile forces, and there are only very few instances in biology where actin and myosin, or at least actin on its own, can result in pushing forces. So most of the time we're talking about pulling forces here. Okay? And of course, we weren't always adults with muscle and muscle tissues. We were before single cells or small little embryos. And we had the challenge of turning from a ball of cells into something more complicated. And as Cassandra showed in her talk more recently, she showed beautiful movies of gastrulation. So these are fruit flies that eventually start from being a ball of cells. So what we're looking at here is indeed a fruit fly embryo, just a cross section of it. Imagine it being sort of elongated, spherical, so like a football shape. We're looking at a cross section in the middle, and we're going to see that here, the same process you saw where you sort of form like a long furrow here. We're going to look at it from the cross section. You'll see that there are contractile forces that pull the top part of the cells inwards. So in that way, these guys can curve inside and start forming tissues here. And absolutely, myosin forces are required there. That's been shown already. And one of the interesting things I find about the cytoskeleton or actin myosin at this early stage is that maybe if you've been to the supermarket before to buy meat, maybe you've seen like a sort of a green shimmer, sort of like a butterfly wing. Has any of you ever seen this before? Yeah? Take a look at like beef or some sort of other meat. Sometimes you will find like little green shine if you reflect the right light the right way. That actually reflects the quasi-crystalline order of the actin myosin bundles inside muscle tissue, meats that you buy. However, you won't find that in these embryos because you don't find quasi-crystalline order in the cytoskeleton. Instead, it's believed to be quite disordered, with actin filaments pointing in all sorts of different directions and these myosin motors sort of embedded inside the network and exerting contractile forces isotropically in all directions. Sorry?
Do you have a picture of those? You've gone to the grocery store?
I'm a vegetarian, so I haven't been interested in taking as many pictures of meat as I should have, but that's a good suggestion for a future talk, actually. And maybe we could all go to the supermarket or something tonight.
Never look at meat the same way. Yeah.
So, you're going to become vegetarian.
To make sure, but when you say quasi-crystalline, you mean the kind of thing with icosahedral symmetry, bipolar?
So you don't see it too well in this picture, but if you sort of take a slice of a muscle tissue, I mean, you have a whole bunch of fibers in this direction, but if you take a slice, you sort of see almost a honeycomb-like lattice. They're pretty well-ordered.
It's hexagonal.
Hexagonal.
That's different from the thing that some people call quasi-crystalline.
Oh, sorry. All right. So
there's a specific thing that some people call quasi-crystals.
All right.
So quasi-crystals.
All right. I did not mean. Yeah, I meant kind of crystalline, not quasi-crystalline. Whatever that definition is. My definition is that there's some sort of periodicity on the length scale of the wavelength of light.
Thank you.
Sorry. Okay. So with that point clarified, the cytoskeleton is disordered as opposed to our muscles. There are a lot of fantastic differences here, but then you can also ask the question, I mean, this is a random network, and embedded are these force-generating molecules, and by the way, they don't generate single forces, but rather pairs of forces, or force dipoles that usually point inward, so they pull in their environment. And then you can ask, how these individual molecules, which only exert forces on the scale of like piconewtons individually, a whole bunch of them over long distances need to sort of communicate, or they need to sum up their forces in order to generate longer length scale strains. In order to, for instance, you know, form a gut, or you know, form a, you know, start modifying the shape of tissues further in development. So one of the big questions is how these myosin motors exert contractile stresses on actin filaments over long distances, keeping in mind this random disordered state. So in order to answer this question, I'm a physicist. I'm not a biologist. In my PhD, I did not work with actual living systems, but rather what I did is I just took these actin filaments from muscle tissue, as well as myosin motors, and sort of recombined them in controlled amounts in the test tube in these in vitro assays. So these are, you know, for a while I was calling them, you know, in these sort of open evenings, I was calling them Franken cells, because they're not really cells. They don't have anything other than just muscle proteins. But at least I know what's inside here. And I can sort of, for instance, all these three experiments, I'll get into exactly what they are, but they all have identical composition except for increasing crosslink concentrations. Now, before I get into crosslinks, first of all, what we are looking at here, so we see a sort of like reddish blob here in the middle. This is sort of we're looking for the top view of a pizza box shaped chamber. So it's about, you know, 2 to 3 millimeters in these directions and about 80 microns in the Z direction, okay? I fill these guys up with actin filaments and with myosin motors. However, these individual filaments and the individual motor complexes, they're too small to see here because we're really zoomed out. So they're on the length scale of, say, microns or so, and here we're on the length scale of millimeters. And furthermore, then what I add, although here we have identical amounts of actin filaments and myosin motors, I increase the concentration of these crosslinks. Now, what are crosslinks? These are molecules that bind, say, two different actin filaments, and you know, you can think of them as molecular glue, all right? And these crosslinks that I add here are fastened crosslinks. So although the forces are more or less the same, the crosslinks will be changing. And what I'll first play is this movie here to the left, and you'll see that few crosslinks mean that the motors. This motor here would like to exert forces, but there are not enough crosslinks to propagate these forces over long distances. So what you'll find is that these motors here and these motors here are essentially independent of each other, and you'll find that we have small clusters that form due to these contractile forces that only exert their forces over small length scales. Okay. Here in this middle movie, I add more crosslinks, and you can imagine then with more crosslinks, motor mortars can sort of pull together over longer distances, so we'll find larger clusters. And then here, I'll add tons of crosslinks, and you'll see that everything is essentially solidly connected.
So what we are seeing is actin, right?
Not
the myosin, right?
So we are seeing both. So I have two channels here. I have red and I have blue. Although the blue sort of looks green because the projector has a slight yellowish tinge. Right. So what you see here is white. No. So what you see here is white, right? The reason you see white is because I have two channels. I have a red channel and I have a cyan channel. And when the red channel corresponds to the actin signal, the cyan channel corresponds to the myosin signal. And when they overlap, we get white.
Like, these are clusters of both actin and myosin.
Exactly. Both of them are in here. Now,
and what's in between?
In between is
a
very
some actin leftover.
Just a little bit actin left over, indeed, that has not been pulled in. Yeah. And in this movie, you'll see contraction with lots of crosslinks. A lot of times they actually do retain the shape of the chamber, sometimes they don't.
What's around it?
Okay, so what you see here, and this has been shown before, let me play a little bit again. Let me see here. So what you see here is that first you see the first contraction, like a first wave of contraction. Now this event did not incorporate all the filament or all the actin around it, so there's still a little bit of actin left over, let's say, and also a little bit of myosin motor and a little bit of crosslinks. Enough such that a second wave can then start forming. Yeah, in the space between it, because these clusters don't incorporate everything. So you see they start forming again, and then they'd like to initiate a full second wave, but they don't. They sort of, you know, sort of accumulate here on the periphery. People have seen like second, third, fourth waves and so on, depending on conditions.
Is pretty much all the myosin gone into the
there's still
square,
most of the myosin is here. There's still some myosin here. If I were to zoom in here with a higher power objective, you would see like some dots of myosin surrounded by like strings of actin or like thick bundles of actin.
You know, there's still a lot of cross-links in there, so it can be well connected because there seems to be almost no myosin left.
Though I cannot observe it, these cross-links are not labeled with fluorescent markers, so all I can see is the actin and myosin here. I do suspect that there must be cross-links here because if there were no cross-links, I would not expect these sort of coordinated motions over longer distances. Yeah.
Do the cross-links open and form then? Or are they irreversible ones
we haven't? That's a very, very good question. And in about like 10 slides or so, I'll get onto this question of whether crosslinks bind reversibly or not. But it's a very good question.
So do they have like different types of contraction?
Yes, they do. And I've currently written a program to try to like get a length, a time scale out of these contractions. But just intuitively from looking at them, on average, I would say, like, I tend to see that these occur faster than these, but you know, there's a lot of.
Why should it depend on the cross-link density, the time scale of contraction?
I don't know. So all I know is that I can tell you that I tend to see faster contractions here. The quantitation is still forthcoming. I would expect that more cross-links mean that more of the sliding motions of myosin motors is converted to some sort of like, you know, long distance, you know, mechanical elastic storage that turns into useful mechanical work and is not dissipated like I think is happening here. But so far this is all conjecture, so I really don't know. It's a good question.
And if you had no crosslinks at all, nothing?
Oh, so if I had no crosslinks at all, indeed I didn't show you the movie, it would be of course right here. On the long scale, you see nothing. It's pretty much remains constant. But if you zoom in, then you find little tiny balls of myosin, and they do move around. And on occasion, they do sort of move towards each other, but then sort of relax back. On very rare occasions, they move towards each other and even coalesce. But you don't have any long length scale behavior.
Will this picture coarsen over time?
This picture coarsen over time? I don't think so. So I think there's not enough of a supporting network around, although I'm not saying there's a vacuum devoid of actin around. I don't think there's enough actin to initiate strong enough forces to cause further coarsening.
They can just move around, right?
They could and they do. However, this is a millimeter, and to diffuse over millimeters would take a very, very, very long time. Yeah.
So what is it that kickstarts the movie? Does the movie begin when you add the crosslinker?
So So that's what you see up here is the time, so in hours, minutes, seconds. What I do is I have one tube with all my proteins except actin and another tube with actin monomers. Actin monomers polymerize to actin filaments when I add salts. So in this other tube I have the salts plus the myosins plus the crosslinks and everything. So I take the contents of this one tube, mix them very quickly with the actin monomers, very quickly put them in this pizza box shaped chamber, seal them, and then image them.
I see.
And so I don't have like an on-off switch, unfortunately.
Okay.
I've tried that.
Mix and then try to start filming right away.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Thanks. Okay. Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
How does the concentration of actin and myosin per volume here compare to the concentration of these molecules in the cytoplasm of a cell?
Very good question. So as far as I know, there don't seem to be very reliable estimates for the concentration of actin inside cells. So far, I've only heard like hearsay.
Yeah, yeah.
But the hearsay, I would say, is around 1 mg/mL of actin. And here we have 0.5 mg/mL of actin. But I don't think the difference between 0.5 and 1 is huge. I think there are further lower concentrations. You don't have entangled networks of actin anymore and so on. And as far as myosin is concerned, I don't know, because the myosin that we're using is a muscle myosin 2B, whereas a lot of cells, for instance, in these embryos, they have a non-muscle myosin 2. They're quite similar. There are differences, though, and we can get into those later on if you like. Yeah.
So you also have ATP?
Yes, it's in.
Can you remove it and see if it is reversible?
So your question is if I can remove the ATP from a system like this will it expand back to its initial state? I don't think so. First of all, I cannot do the experiment where I remove ATP because these are sealed chambers, and the moment I open them up, they can evaporate quickly and disturb the system. Although I have tried experiments where I've tried inhibiting the myosin molecules with a drug, and I got mixed results there. I don't think they're reversible, though. So if I do the experiment with actin, myosin, crosslinks without ATP, so the problem there is that actin always includes a little bit of ATP, so and that activates the motors. In that case, you definitely don't get these long length scale fast contractions, that for sure. And I also don't think that a reversible diffusive mechanism could cause transport over such long distances.
Without ATP, you don't get any contraction.
Sorry?
You shouldn't get any contraction without the ATP, I would think, right?
I would expect you would not get any contraction without ATP, but my experiment, experimentally, I cannot realize a completely zero ATP system. Otherwise, the actin filaments would be unstable. They require ATP in their cores.
Is muscle myosin tried to be cooperative, right? Get to the way to see any aggregation?
Yes. I won't get into that into this talk. But we have seen. I had seen, and also people in my lab previously, have seen sort of like clusters of myosin with actin around them, coalescing, and then the myosin core is sort of fusing. And we definitely think that's because the myosins are processive, and we also think processivity is important in order to exert these forces over long length scales.
Processive.
Okay, so what does processive mean? I'll get to your question, Zilke, real quick. A single myosin motor, and there are tons of them, all right? There are vast review articles out there citing tons of work on all the different myosin isoforms. One of the quantities that you can use to sort of distinguish different myosins is their processivity. That is, how long do they walk on a single filament before sort of unbinding and diffusing away? And as it turns out, a single myosin motor. So I show you this little cartoon. This is a whole discussion here, but what this is a single sort of myosin dimer, or tons of little myosin dimers sort of arranged head to tail like this, or sort of with their tails stuck together and their little heads in opposite directions. A single myosin motor is not very processive. It just sort of walks once or twice on a filament and sort of goes away. But there are other myosins that are very processive and continue to walk. However, these non-processive individual myosins, when they cluster up into these sort of thick filaments, is what they're called, then these are very processive. I hope that serves for 30 seconds. Where do I get them from?
Yeah.
Rabbit muscle. You have to chew up rabbit muscle in a blender, and it's a disgusting process. And then at the end, you get a clear, colorless, odorless liquid that resembles nothing like the tissue purified. Yeah, you can imagine as a vegetarian, the first time I did this prep, I was not keen on participating. After a while, you realize it's work.
Similar vein, what's the processivity of your myosin? How many
So I can so we believe that based on previous literature and the way we've prepared these, that we should have on the order of, like, say 100 or so myosin molecules per thick filament, and we've tried measuring that, but we haven't gotten results where we can really pinpoint the exact number, and then what their exact processivity is we also don't know. We just based on previous work.
One more question. Is there any liquid crystal order in the system?
Yes. Okay. In the absence of crosslinks, in the absence of myosin motors, actin filaments only, they do form liquid crystals. However, at concentrations higher than the ones that I use here. So in the absence of forces or anything, an almost equilibrium sort of just static arrangement of, not static, but just a simple arrangement of passive filaments, will only form liquid crystals concentrations that are about tenfold higher than the ones that I use here.
Once you have that big squish event,
yes.
Is that liquid crystalline?
So I still don't think there's liquid crystalline. There could be small domains of liquid crystalline order, but I would expect myosin motor forces to frustrate any long range liquid crystalline order just because there are a lot of entanglements in here, and these motors, they really pull in things, I think perhaps quite messily. So I wouldn't expect this to exhibit the same kind of liquid crystalline order as a simple passive suspension of actin filaments.
I know, it's funny. It seems like a nice square shape, and is that just because of the shape of the box, or is there another?
It's exactly because I think it's reasonable to assume that it's because of the shape of the box. I haven't systematically varied the shape of the box to definitively show that, but I think these contractions are pretty. I think the reason is that there's so many crosslinks that
the shape of the box.
Yeah. I think so. Gautam.
How do you ensure that whatever you see is only a consequence of the myosin and not because the actin itself is treadmilling or doing anything?
So we were thinking of trying experiments where we would enhance treadmilling. However, I haven't even gotten to those experiments. I tried some other experiments with related molecules that didn't really give me what I was expecting. Treadmilling rates in these experiments are fairly low because we don't add any sort of treadmilling factors. We don't add any sort of minus n depolymerizing agents. We don't add any profilin to allow to make it easier for new filaments to add to the plus end. But I do agree that when you add those factors, actin filaments can treadmill on the order of a micron or so per second, is it? I think. So, but the velocities here are much less. Okay. So, main story of the slide is keeping actin filament density and myosin density constant. Increased crosslinks give you bigger clusters. How can we make sense of this? So far I showed you pretty movies, and I have tons of them. I made 50 experiments. Here's another similar one. And how do I quantify a movie like this? And for a while, Haisha was suggesting I try particle tracking, and particle tracking for me, especially with something as weirdly shaped as this, I thought wasn't trivial. So I sort of came up with my own alternative algorithm, which isn't perfect, but I think does a good enough job. So what I do is I take the final frame of a movie that I've acquired, which you see here. This white blob is the same as that yellow blob over there. And you see also these little white speckles that correspond to myosin clusters, actin myosin clusters. And around each blob, I sort of define a territory, or at least MATLAB does it for me. And the territory is sort of defined the halfway point between two clusters, or the extrema of two clusters. So for instance, this point here and that point here defines, the halfway point here defines this line. For instance, also these two guys there.
So you're doing the center of mass of each blob?
Not center of mass. If I took the center of mass, then this cluster here and that cluster here, the halfway point would be somewhere there. So it's always the extrema of a cluster.
You have some.
It's like some kind of Voronoi construction, but very different.
It's like a Voronoi, but it's different because it's not center of mass, and it's called a distance transform in MATLAB. Yeah.
How do you define your threshold for a cluster? Just anything that you see?
Otsu threshold of the myosin channel. So the actin channel, there's still a little bit of actin in the background, but very little detectable myosin. So because my myosin signal is so much better than my actin, I just thresholded my myosin signal. Cassandra, did you have your hand up?
Same question as Silke.
I see. Yes?
Did someone say anything about diffusion-limited aggregation?
Diffusion-limited aggregation. I think diffusion-limited aggregation occurs, but in a system where I chop up all the filaments really tiny, so that there's no entangled network that bears stress, but rather I have a lot of things that are diffusing. And in this case, and I'm not going to show this in the talk, but I can show you later, I do see clusters of actin of short actin filaments and myosin. When they finally diffuse towards each other and close enough, then they can sort of coalesce, and then they sort of continue to diffuse, of course, with a smaller diffusion constant because they're bigger, and they keep coarsening in this way. Yes. But I don't think diffusion-limited aggregation is appropriate here because of the elastic background.
No, it's pretty fractal.
Yes, it is pretty fractal. There are reasons why we think it may be fractal, which may or may not be related to diffusion-limited aggregation, maybe percolation theory.
Plus tearing.
Yes.
Percolation plus tearing.
Yes, we think it's percolation plus tearing. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So I just take this final image, I define my little zones here, and then I sort of go backwards in time, and all the while letting these guys expand and then redrawing these boundaries. And then what I'm left with is the initial frame that I took, where the concentration of actin and myosin over at least these very long length scales is relatively homogeneous, definitely far more so than here. So that the size of these individual final, or these clusters in the end of the analysis is a sort of a measure of the mass inside a cluster like this.
It's not cluster?
Yes. Yes. So like they say this big cluster here corresponds to this guy, and say say this small cluster here probably corresponds to, I think, one of these guys maybe. Sorry? Sorry? Is what connected? Yes, whatever is inside a cluster, I claim, is contracts in a connected way, independent of other clusters. So maybe I can play this in forwards time now.
So you only define the clusters at the final stage, and then you take
that's
the
right.
You don't define them at each
stage. No, because if you give me only this image and no movie, I have no idea how to draw these boundaries. In fact, Misha, one of the theorists, he tried to do this with a simulation and it didn't work. But it was a tempting thought.
Although the fact that you get an image like this at the beginning suggests that the little individual beginning clusters don't travel very far.
Oh, I still don't understand your question. So I mean, indeed, there's still like little clusters here,
yeah.
And you say that. Oh, sorry, you mean these little clusters, right?
That's right. So,
that's right.
Or the tree-like cluster in,
yep.
In that frame, it was made from molecules that came from pretty close by. Most of the molecules that made it came from close to it, as opposed to way up in the corner.
Oh no! So these guys here came off from further up here from further up here.
Yes.
Those are these guys here, and eventually follow this kind of trajectory.
Right.
Whereas, for instance, this cluster means that only the material around it eventually was in the cluster that is somewhere around there.
Right, so they don't sort of cross the entire length of the frame.
That's right.
Very much.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So with an image like this, cluster size is a measure of cluster mass. So I can give you the sizes, for instance, of the largest cluster, which for this talk I'll call Xi1. And in this particular experiment, you see is 1.2 millimeters. And I'll give you the size of the second largest cluster, which for this talk I'll always call Xi2. And here it's about half a millimeter. So now with this sort of quantification, I can look at many experiments. You see, what I'm going to plot here is these two different length scales, the largest and the second largest cluster, versus the cross-link concentration. And for networks that have very few cross-links, we get small clusters, so small, largest, and second largest clusters. And you can see that here in these images. You just have little tiny domains everywhere. As I increase the cross-link concentration, I start to get larger clusters. So that's why both Xi1 and Xi2 start increasing. Okay. However, when we have lots of cross-links and everything's well connected, we have one very large cluster. And if we have any secondary clusters, they tend to be really small, which is why Xi1 continues to increase towards the system size here at around 2 to 3 millimeters, whereas Xi2 starts to decrease again. Okay. So with this sort of quantification, it was more or less inspired due to exchanges with theoreticians who were very interested in percolation theory. And yes, question.
Question, how did you define the size of the cluster? Is it something like the radius of divergence, or what is it?
No, not even. It's a square root area.
Oh, OK.
So I just take the area here that I measure, I take the square root of that, and that gives me a length scale.
So if you have a really stringy object, which can be quite long, the cluster is still
that's right.
Of size, or almost.
That's right. That's right. Although I do not tend to, from looking at these movies, I do not tend to find extremely long, thin clusters. However, if I did indeed, then the square root of area would probably not be the right choice, and indeed a radius of gyration would probably be something worth considering.
So all this is from the initial image, right?
From the initial image? Oh, so.
So you go back in time and get the cluster size from the initial image.
Yes, although as I mentioned earlier, if you only give me the initial image and I don't do any of the analysis, I would never be able to draw these boundary lines. I would need the entire movie. So if I analyze the entire movie, then I can produce an image like
so
this.
So is this equivalent to the cluster-cluster separation in the final image?
I have not shown that. I have not shown that. I would expect that they would be related. But this also gets into a finer point about Yeah, about exactly what the distance between these clusters is. We can discuss this later. But so far, I don't have any hard data yet. Okay. So, so over the course of this project, I learned a lot about percolation theory. And I suspect many of you have been exposed to percolation theory. But for those like me that hadn't seen it before, real briefly, I'm going to introduce a sort of simple percolation model. Imagine we have sort of a model where we have lines that sort of represent actin filaments. And imagine here these circles that are places where these filaments sort of intersect. Imagine it's the two-dimensional model. These are potential binding sites for crosslinks. So imagine then we introduce a probability p. And for now, we'll assume this probability p is small. A small probability for a crosslink to bind to one of these sites. So that's what I denote with these like sort of purple circles. Purple circle here means there's a crosslink. So these two filaments are now connected, but disconnected from the rest, as are these two, as well as those two. And so you can imagine that for small probabilities, so for small p's, all we have are like either single filaments or small clusters of filaments, but most the entire thing is disconnected. Now, in the opposite limit of p going to 1, where crosslinks pretty much occupy every binding site, the entire thing is well connected as like one solidly connected mass. And percolation theory furthermore tells us that there exists a probability p between, of course, 0 and 1, called sort of like critical probability, where you have just enough connections that you have a cluster of connected filaments that span the length scale of your system. So you should be able to trace a path from bottom to top, hopping along filaments and crosslinks. Okay? So if we look at what percolation theory tells us, what we would expect from Xi1 and Xi2 is that we would expect Xi1 to increase till the system size, and Xi2 to increase and decrease, exhibiting a peak at this critical probability. Okay? And of course, so this was done with an actual simulation, just a simple percolation model. And if you compare it with our experimental data, it seemed to suggest a very good agreement. You can see we're finding Xi1 increases, whereas Xi2 increases and then decreases again. Yes?
If you look at the full cluster size distribution.
Yes, that's in like three slides. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Xi1 settles off because of finite size effect?
That's right. Mm-hmm. It tends towards the system size. So the square root of this is Xi1 for p approaching 1.
Do some links break sometimes?
Yes, and I'm getting to that in maybe five slides.
Okay, and there's fractal behavior over the diverging length scale.
At PC. For a simple percolation model, indeed, the largest clusters are fractal in shape, whereas this is Euclidean in shape.
Right, but for P, for instance, just a little ways below PC, you would still expect fractal scaling, but only up to the correlation length.
You would expect fractal scaling, but the problem is that the largest cluster, does not scale with the system size enough that it would survive in the thermodynamic limit.
So you don't see anything that looks like a fractal when p is less than pc.
I suspect it is fractal in shape. I think so. I think even here the small clusters are fractal enough, but I think.
But just up to this correlation length, whatever.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Up to the correlation length, which is in percolation theory defined as the size of the second largest cluster. Interestingly enough, because that's what mimics the susceptibility in magnetic systems. But that's the point we can get into later. Okay. So far it seems that my experiments in percolation theory seem to agree. So how can we further test this agreement? Percolation theory, in general, expects that at this PC, this is a critical point. So at a critical point, we should expect critical behavior. Now, what is exactly critical behavior? There's a lot of there's a lot you can say about critical behavior. And my next slide is going to be sort of like a simple introduction to a sort of related system that I think also other people have shown exhibits some sort of criticality, although I don't think it's still fully understood. And these are flocks of birds, and I like these movies a lot. So what we're looking at here, indeed, each individual black speck is a bird flying in the sky with its neighbors. And what people have been able to show is that there's some sort of diverging correlation length scale, some sort of critical behavior, if you will, of birds flying in the sky in swarms like this. Now, before I play the movie, And before I show you what critically connected looks like, at least in the case of birds, I want you to imagine what a locally correlated flock of birds would look like. It would sort of be like a thermal bath of birds flying independently in random directions. There'd be no cohesive motion. It would just be it would look more like a swarm of gnats or flies or something, rather than a flock of birds. Meanwhile, if you have a fully correlated swarm of birds, the swarm would behave like a rigidly connected mass, and it would fly like a huge sphere, a huge solid blob that does not deform everywhere as it translates in space. However, in this case, critically correlated, we see something kind of in between, and we see sort of like density waves, propagation of waves and things that extend over the length scale of the entire flock. Okay, it's an interesting question why people exhibit critical behavior in certain biological systems to begin with. And of course, the way I would define critical behavior in my system is different from here, because here you require a velocity-velocity autocorrelation function. In my case, you'll see that it's different. However, at least the concepts may or may not be related, and at least people have been using the word critical to sort of describe behavior like this, as well as the behavior I claim is also critical. So how can I show criticality in my system? And this relates to the question I think Silke was asking about all cluster sizes. So in this plot, I show you all the data I showed you before, but rather having these two length scales as a function of cross-link concentration, I show you Xi1, the largest length scale, and Xi2, the second largest length scale, plotted against each other in sort of like a phase diagram, or not phase diagram, but just a scatter plot. And each symbol represents an experiment, and the shape of the symbol represents the cross-link concentration going from smallest, or sort of weakly connected, to strongly connected. Okay. And each experiment can therefore can fall anywhere in this triangle, because of course Xi1 is always larger than Xi2. And we see that for weakly connected systems, we're here in the bottom left corner where both length scales are small. And as we increase cross-link concentration, we increase both these length scales along this line as we reach the top here. And then as we get even further into cross-link concentration, we remember that this length scale continues to increase, whereas this decreases again, which is why we go back down this way along this line. All right? And based on this plot, now I can sort of divide all these experiments into three different classes or regimes. So here on the bottom left-hand corner, I have what I call local contraction, where I just have small clusters. Here on the right-hand side, I have global contraction, where I have one large cluster and, if anything, a smaller second cluster. And then up here, what I claim to be is critically connected. Now, how can I justify this claim for critically connected networks? Instead of looking at Xi1 and Xi2, I look at all the cluster sizes. What I'm going to show you here are distributions of cluster sizes. So here's the area of a cluster, sum in micron squared rather than a length scale. And here, it's sort of like a waterfall plot. This is one, this pretended it's also one, and this is also one. If you've seen a waterfall plot before, it makes sense. Otherwise, think of each of these points as probability approaching one. And for now, just focus on the circles, which shows you the histogram. The line is just the complementary cumulative probability distribution function, which just represents the data the same way. So just focus on the histograms here. So for the local contraction, we find a probability of finding small clusters, but not large clusters. For the global contraction, we find a probability of finding large clusters here in this histogram, and this histogram here for small clusters, but nothing in between. Whereas here, for the critically connected case, we find, of course, a probability of small, of large, and of intermediate-sized clusters. And from this length scale onwards, the data here are consistent with the power law. And this power law is evidence, or we believe evidence, of critical behavior. Furthermore, not only do we have a power law, the slope of this power law, or the exponent here, is -1.91, plus minus 0.06. And what we would expect from percolation theory is -2.05. So we're reasonably close, we think, to what we'd expect from the critical behavior in percolation theory. So this is sort of the justification as to why we think these networks here represent some sort of critical state, whatever it may be, but at least it seems to behave similarly to what we find in percolation theory. Okay? Any questions here?
What's the other straight line?
Okay, so this straight line here is exactly this. It's representing the same data that's encoded here. It's just that the problem with histograms is that you need to define a bin size. So, you know, you need to, I mean, I could give you a histogram, you know, where instead of showing bin sizes of this big, I can show them to you half as big or twice as big, okay? Depends on how finely scaled you want your histogram to look. And then, of course, you can't go too finely scaled. Whereas this here, which is sort of, you can think of it as 1 minus the integral of this. It's just sort of like a cumulative probability distribution function, but the complementary one, it's 1 minus. And it's just a way of representing the same data just without having to choose a bin size. And if you ask me, I think this plot, you know, since it doesn't depend on bin size, it more accurately represents your data. It also shows if your power law actually starts wiggling around, and it's been, and there are people that are very that have been doing a lot of work trying to wag their fingers at physicists who drive power laws just by taking histograms and drawing a straight line along log plot. There are actually statistical techniques out there to show whether or not you really do have a power law by comparing against randomly generated data and performing Kolmogorov-Smirnov test to see whether your data is indistinguishable or not from the randomly generated data, which is what I did and which is why I can claim here power law. And those people like this better. Physicists tend to like this better.
You are doing these on these active jazz, active mice. Have people done this for boring polyacrylamide jazz or regular jazz?
So I think the difficulty there, so indeed with a polyacrylamide gel, you can also add some sort of crosslink and you can systematically vary it. And you see that above, so and the way you test whether or not the crosslink has a certain effect is by shearing the network, shearing the gel externally. And you find that too few crosslinks, it behaves like a liquid, and then above certain critical number of crosslinks, it behaves like a solid. And sort of sol-gel transition is also what's called a rigidity percolation, and that is a completely different universality class from from the percolation theory critical behavior, where the percolation theory critical behavior is more, rather than being a transition from a liquid to a solid phase, is more from like a non-conducting to a fully conducting phase. So like a random network of like say a conducting small rods above a certain critical point will conduct electricity from one side to the other. So interestingly enough, this behavior is more similar to the electrical conductivity case than to this solid gel transition case. Curiously enough. So questions here.
Sorry, can I comment on this?
Okay.
I believe percolation theory was tested experimentally in the context of the solid gel transition. This goes back to the gen, and then Alpha originally starting with the mean field argument of Florin, and then Newell developing a critical theory for it. So, I mean, I'm not talking about rigidity percolation.
Okay.
It's different, but the standard solid gel transition is really the percolation transition.
I don't, so what is the percolation transition? I see a conductivity and a rigidity percolation transition. And what I understand with a conductivity percolation transition is that you do have a cluster that touches the bottom and touches the top, but is fractal in shape. And if I were to shear this, I would not see, my rheometer would not measure any sort of solid-like resistance from this fractally connected cluster. But if I were to send charge through, then yes.
I agree with you that there are many percolation transitions.
Okay.
What I call the percolation transition is, so to speak, the simplest side of one percolation, the way it was originally formulated. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Then I want to hear more about this after the talk. And I'm curious.
Is this supposed to be three-dimensional or quasi-two-dimensional?
It's quasi-two-dimensional. It's like a pizza box. The smallest length scale, so the height of the pizza box, is 80 microns, which is compares to, like, say, a typical average actin filament length of around 10 microns and a myosin thick filament length of around 1 micron. So this is already about, you know, 80 times larger than the component molecules. And then, of course, in this dimension, it's, you know, millimeters, so it's like hundreds, thousands times larger.
Yes, so I mean, just essentially as a comment, so if I understand what you're saying correctly, you're saying this is some type of essentially connectivity percolation of your pathway crosslinks on your actin backbone.
Yes, though, okay, all right. There's an experiment that I wish I could do, but I cannot. That is, just take actin filaments and crosslinks and systematically add varying amounts of crosslinks. Somehow, have full knowledge, which I do not, with a microscope that, all right, filament 1 and filament 2 are connected with crosslink A, but then not connected to filament 17 and filament 34, even though they're touching. Because I cannot visualize crosslinks, and I really think the resolution of the microscope would limit you from doing this, especially reliably. Because of that, I don't think it would be possible with just actin filaments and crosslinks alone, currently, experimentally, to verify a sort of conductivity percolation transition. But because I have motors here, I can visualize some sort of domain of connectivity just by seeing how they contract. I'm lucky in that the motors sort of reveal the connectivity of the underlying network for me to a certain extent.
So it's always an assumption. It's actually the same one we see in our 1D model. It's basically, are you connected through your filaments or not?
Exactly. Although, of course, as I'm going to get in a few slides, the motors do cause crossings to unbind. Yes. Any other questions?
Histogram you obtained, which concentration did you obtain? There's various concentration.
Yes, you're right. Very good point. So what I did in the beginning was I just tried to look at these histograms, not according to this classification, but rather, all right, what does it look like for this one concentration, for the next? And I didn't find any statistically significant power laws there. The reason for that, which is actually what I'm going to get into in my next slide. So just 1 second. Any other questions? OK. So indeed, as I was pointing out, you could try to just look at distributions for each individual crossing concentration. But if you notice, especially up here, and you can look at the squares. These squares, you find them here, you find them in here, and you find them there. So there seems, even though I prepare my samples identically, my samples in principle are not exactly identical. There's always noise, with the volumes you can measure, the pipettes that you use and everything. And then furthermore, what you notice is that up here at the tip of this triangle, there are symbols that, there are squares, there are circles, there are triangles, and so on. And an order of magnitude difference in crosslink concentration yields samples that end up here, which is experimentally quite surprising. Because normally, when you're trying to find a critical point experimentally, you really need to have a very good control of your experimental system and fine-tune all the experimental parameters to get your system to exhibit this critical behavior. And that's somehow not consistent with the idea that all these guys are ending up there. So this order of magnitude difference in crossing concentration, it's also related to a more qualitative observation that in critical behavior from percolation theory, you expect this Xi2 peak to be quite narrow. Whereas in experiments, we find that it's quite broad. It's about an order of magnitude in crossing concentration. Now, of course, I can't relate crossing concentration to P directly without making some strong assumptions. So this is still a qualitative observation, but still, this is suspiciously broad. This leads us to believe that somehow in our experimental system, because we have this broad Xi2 peak, because we have all these crossing concentrations ending up here, that this critical behavior somehow needs to be robust. And as an aside, we are not using the word self-organized criticality here, for those of you that are familiar with this concept. But we're saying that there's some sort of robustness that, that could drive the system to this critical state. And what the difference is between robust and self-organized criticality, talk to me, please, after this talk. I don't think it's worth wasting too much breath here. But either way, we do believe in some sort of robustness in our experimental system. And it's not predicted by standard percolation theory. So what do we need to do in order to model this robustness or model our system? We need to depart from percolation theory. And the first departure we can think of is this has been known for decades already. We have two filaments, crosslink, and we're all at the molecular scale. There's a certain probability that this crosslink will unbind just due to thermal forces. There's a certain off rate, completely in a passive system. And furthermore, what we do know also, this has also been known for quite a while, is that if the crosslink is undergoing certain tension, due to perhaps myosins that are exerting forces on the filaments, this off-rate increases. So the, you know, the crosslink suffers this tension and is just more likely to unbind. Furthermore, we can imagine some sort of an effect where if there are lots of crosslinks in the background, and say there are forces or whatever, and somehow this crosslink tends to unbind, before these two filaments have enough time to separate from each other, it could be that other crosslinks in the background could rebind, and an increase in crosslink concentration could effectively reduce the off rate. Okay. So if we take these two effects into consideration, we can modify percolation theory by including an off rate. It's not constant, but rather depends on tension and on the concentration of crosslinks in the system. Yes?
That's an unusual assumption, right? Normally on rates are proportional to concentration, but off rates are independent of concentration. Why do you do that?
So the reason why we include this term here is that in the percolation, or in the simulation that I'm about to show you in the next slide, there was no obvious way of incorporating rebinding without explicitly simulating crosslinks themselves and the way they diffuse after they unbind. The theoretician colleagues of mine, they don't do that. I'll show you their model. So that's sort of what this is in, for their model, the way they reincorporate this unbinding.
Is this correct that you do not take into account explicitly the on rates, or the effectively the off rates becomes conservation dependent?
That's right.
And of course, the rebinding may occur at a slightly different point along the cation filament.
That's right. So imagine. So the way you can get this effective concentration, this constant here, is by comparing how long it takes the time scales essentially of two filaments moving on the order of their mesh size in response to a tension exerted by the myosins. And indeed, you can imagine that even though they say this guy's pulled in this direction, this guy's been pulled in this direction, it doesn't mean that the binding site is disappeared. It can still be there. However, we think that because of, you'll see in the movies also, but also from the experiments, eventually what does happen is not just some sort of perfect orthogonal sliding, but rather everything sort of gets crunched up. And if these filaments sort of get contracted to a distant cluster away, then crosslinks here would have no chance of rebinding again. Those are the assumptions that go into here.
So the motors are static in your
simulation? Let me show you the simulation. So the simulation is not very sophisticated because they're very interested, of course, in percolation theory, and this is viewed more as a modification to percolation theory rather than molecular dynamics or Monte Carlo simulation. So there's definitely still a lot of open ground for simulating the system here. This is just sort of like a simple toy percolation-like model. So the model is as follows. Imagine you have a hexagonal lattice, or triangular hexagonal lattice of points, or say nodes, and between nodes you can establish bonds that represent actin filaments. And at every node where there is at least two bonds coming off, you can have a probability of having a crosslink bind there. And then between pairs of nodes, as long as there's a bond, they incorporate motor activity not by explicitly modeling myosin motors, but rather introducing some sort of a force dipole between these pairs of nodes and between every pair of nodes that is connected by a bond. Is that clear? And then, of course, these crosslinks, they can unbind with a certain off rate, as I showed you in the previous slide. But when they unbind, they do not rebind anymore. Just because this whole thing can move, and then of course you'd have to consider the fact that unbound crossing would have to diffuse all the way over to the place where the cluster ended up going. So
all the sites are under motors.
Yes.
This works good at high motor densities.
You can think of this as some sort of coarse graining, I'm not telling.
Some of the links could be free of motor tension.
Sorry.
Some of the links could be free of tension.
Okay, this leads to also a very subtle point, relating to the tension exerted by the motors themselves, and the tension actually felt by a crosslink itself. And if you have a situation like this, can everyone see actin filaments sort of organized in an asterisk? Oh, there's lights. Perfect. Imagine actin filaments are organized in an asterisk shape. And then we have crosslink here. And then we have tensions, motor-induced tensions going in all directions. Because the sum of forces here is zero, the crosslink itself actually would not feel any tension. You only feel tension when there's some sort of imbalance of force around this node. This definitely goes.
That's what I'm saying. If you don't have motors acting on all the filaments, right? Say at lower motor density, some of these links could be free of tension. So as a result, you
exactly. Exactly. But as you can see anyway, this model is not meant to, percolation theory also doesn't really deal with microscopic mechanisms per se, but rather is a bit more coarse-grained, especially when you're trying to fit something like percolation theory to this complex system. So indeed, it's still an open question. The firing range is definitely big and broad to start asking how these, how different molecular interactions between motors and crosslinks and filaments could lead to this kind of a coarse-grained behavior. However, this is just a simple model, which captures enough of what we think could be relevant to the system. So those are the assumptions we're making. Okay? So it's essentially like percolation theory, just that crosslinks are allowed to unbind now in response to forces. And I think at least just by looking at the movies of the simulation, they look very similar to my experiments to a certain extent. So of course, just as I showed you with my experiments, here are three different movies. Few crosslinks, intermediate number of crosslinks, high number of crosslinks. Thank you. And I'm going to play this movie here with low number of crosslinks, and you find it breaks up into small clusters. And then here, you do the same simulation with more crosslinks, and you get slightly larger clusters. You see that these guys here, they contract over longer length scales. And then eventually, when you have tons of crosslinks, you have very long, large length scale macroscopic contractions. Okay, so one of the main results of the simulations is in this graph here. Let me just walk through this graph slowly. So first here, on the x-axis, we see the crosslink concentration. And on the y-axis, we see these two different length scales as I showed you before. Now we see two different sets of symbols. We see open symbols and closed symbols. The open symbols are a simulation without motors, which corresponds to a simple percolation theory, whereas the closed symbols are what happens when you add motors to the system, okay? Given the same initial parameters and everything. In the passive no motor case, we see that Xi1 increases to the system size, Xi2 increases and decreases, as we've seen before. And what I shade here in this striped yellow region is what I call sort of like the critical zone. The projection on the x-axis here of the symbols that happen to be above 10% of the system size. So you see that this critical zone here is very narrow, which means that we have a very narrow Xi2 peak. Whereas if we look at the system with motors, we see that this Xi2 peak broadens out, and this critical zone is larger than this one. So the main message is that the presence of motor activity sort of broadens this zone over which you find power law in cluster size distribution. So motor activity would broaden this critical zone. Yes?
This is for your particular model of changing fall-off, right? So sort
absolutely.
Of any change of this thing would prompt a bit for presumably wrong critical zones if you had fluctuations now in these quantities.
Can you repeat your question? Because I don't think I understood it.
Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, saying that, if you did not have the particular additional fall-off rates of your...
So if KF were constant or zero?
Yes.
Okay.
Then we would expect motors on the move to make a difference, right?
That's right. That's right. So the reason whether KF is zero or finite or varies with force doesn't matter in this case because there are no forces to even speak of. So you can imagine if it's constant, then at some point everything gets disconnected. But in most cases, this is just a trivial or classical percolation theory. And then when you add motors plus this K-off assumption, you get a broader peak. Yes?
In the simulations, did they check that the exponents are the same?
Yes, so the exponents are awesome. And there's also, which I'll allude to only at the very end of the talk, because there's although this work is published, there's still some follow-up work that still has our head scratching a little bit. Although their power law is also close to, the exponent is close to 2, it turns out that they found another percolation model called a no-unclaves percolation model, which I'll get into towards the end of the talk, which has a different exponent, which is close to minus 1.86. We can talk about that in a bit. Any other questions?
I'm just trying to understand the K-off with the exponential. Is it just Kramer's problem? Just trying to put something over a barrier?
Yes, that's where the dependencies on exponential factors in the off rate come from. Okay, so far I've shown you simulations and movies of a fixed motor concentration, but varied concentration. I can do the opposite, where instead I keep the cross-set concentration fixed, but I vary the motor concentration in experiment. And what do you find when you have lots of crosslinks, so a very well-connected network, but few motors? Not much happens. Now, I say not much happens. Even already in this movie, you can sort of see that there's a little, non-homogeneities over a smaller length scale, although not a length scale. And furthermore, if I play this movie back and forth real quickly, this is 1 hour, 20 minutes after I initiate the experiment. So if I play this a lot more quickly, you'll see, kind of see sort of like collective breathing or, long scale, quasi-static rearrangements that we still don't fully understand. That was an interesting observation. But either way, I cannot associate a cluster size to these guys. Only when I add more crosslinks do I get isotropic contractions. And then if I add more motors, I get macroscopic contraction. And if I add even more motors, what would you expect?
Little bits,
and that's what we find. And these little bits, we definitely believe are due to, are increased amounts of little bits, we definitely think are due to motor-induced rupture events, which we think are cross-link unbinding events. And at least we remember these in a sort of like a higher resolution, higher power objective movies. And here you see like clusters of actin here, and then in the inside are myosin. So these white splotches are, as I said, actin and myosin co-localizing. And around here, there's only actin. And you see there's sort of like a bridge between the two, which we presume is connected with crosslinks. And these little smaller white spots of myosin motors. Now, we don't know whether it's these spots or those spots or which spots are responsible for the tensions that eventually snap this thing in half. But at least we definitely think that this thing cannot snap in the absence of myosin forces. I mean, I've never seen a movie like this up close in a system without myosin forces. So we definitely think that more force leads to more ruptures, as in our K-off assumption.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
In the theory of fracture, we generally assume it's the largest hole that is the most susceptible to failure.
Yes.
And there's a theory called Griffith theory that tells you what the critical hole size is.
Yes.
So we look at that and we see like Swiss cheese, sort of, kind of, right?
Yes.
On the left side.
Yeah.
And then the next one is broken.
Yes.
So can you like figure out there's like the biggest stress in the system and the biggest hole size in the system and figure out that's the greatest.
So there's one very big difference between our system and the assumptions made in Griffith's theory.
Griffith is a uniform strain, and here you have heterogeneous strain.
One very important thing to note, though, is that in Griffith's theory, he assumed a uniform external stress that is propagated through the material, whereas here the stress is generated internally. I actually suspect that the scaling of hole size with stress, which is, Griffith's theory says hole size is proportional to critical hole size is proportional to 1 over stress squared, I think.
It depends if you're in 2D or 3D, and this looks pretty 2D.
Okay, but there's a certain exponent there, depending on dimension. I suspect that that exponent is changed in the presence of internal forces, because internal forces would sort of heal the area of highest stress that would normally occur around the, that would build up around the edges of the largest hole. But I haven't experimentally been able to show that. And so far, we also don't have a theoretical grasp on it, which is a very exciting open question. Unfortunately, I can only give you hand-waving hypotheses. Yeah. Okay. So more force from myosins means more ruptures. And more force, we also believe, at least the smaller pluses that I showed you in the movie. Here we have motor concentration plotted on this axis. Here we have these two length scales. And if we look at Xi1, the largest length scale, it decreases an experiment with approximately sort of like a inverse proportional dependence. And in simulation, here's experiment, here's simulation. Also find something quite similar for a given a crossing concentration in the simulations. We also tend to find one over force scaling. But so far, this is just still kind of a hand wavy. I mean, this is kind of what we find. At least the negative exponent is pretty clear, I would say. So all these observations lead us to propose a sort of, I'm not going to call it a phase diagram. I think I should call it a regime diagram, or maybe someone else has a better term. But you know, some sort of diagram that shows you these different regimes of behavior that we found in experiment and simulation. So on this axis, we plot connectivity, broadly defined. And here, force, also broadly defined. And here, this critical point from percolation theory at a certain critical connectivity. And in the absence of force, all we find is sort of either small clusters or large clusters, and then a critical point with only a very small region around it that exhibits critical behavior, similar to percolation theory. And as we increase force, what we believe is happening is that networks, which are initially better connected than the critical behavior, so they're well connected, but there's force present, the presence of internal forces causes crossings to unbind, and this process of unbinding continues until this network attains a state that we believe is similar to this state here. And then at this state, the global forces due to these internal stresses, they vanish because we have a very disconnected network, and then this unbinding process stops. This is what we believe is happening, and that's what we think is reflected in this diagram here. So why this sort of critically connected zone sort of opens up, and we think here off to top right, but of course we don't understand this space well enough. Okay. What is more or less clear are at least timescales that in sort of this limit and this limit. And we think that in this limit here, let's talk about this limit here first. In this limit where we have high force and low connectivity, we think that the timescale that's important here is the unbinding rate of crosslinks, because forces accelerate unbinding of crosslinks and they just keep popping off real quick. So this is the timescale that is more important, let's say, in this limit, and then whereas in this limit here, we have high connectivity but low force. So the crosslinks, they remain bound to where they are. Their off rate is pretty low, and the time scale that dominates is instead the time scale of stresses from an individual cluster of motors propagates through the network, which we have a very bad handle on. There's no formula for this as far as we know. But at least we were able to estimate what the time scales we should expect are from previous experiments, and at least these two sort of match up. And one take-home message that kind of surprised us in the beginning, though it's not, at first it was sort of counterintuitive, is that here in this limit, this global contraction limit, we require a low force. Normally you like to think that in order for a tissue to deform over long distances, you would expect you need high forces. But we find that's not necessarily the case, because eventually you hit a limit where high forces generated internally result in too much stress on the individual components that connect these forces over long distances anyway, leading to these ruptures. So I think in biology, I would expect any system, any biologically relevant system that wants to remodel itself due to these internal forces should be in this regime, definitely not this regime. And as an example of biological systems in this regime or that regime, there have actually been experiments done on fruit flies. These are fantastic movies. And we ask whether framework actually does apply to tissues of connected cells that are exerting contractile stresses. So what we're looking at is the same form of the same process of gastrulation that I showed you in the very beginning of the talk, and that also Cassandra showed you yesterday or so. where now instead of looking at a cross-section, as I showed you in the beginning, we're sort of looking at a tangent plane close to the surface of these cells. And what we're going to see is that these cells, you can already sort of slightly see their outlines, they're expressing a fluorescent myosin. And you'll see that these myosin force-generating molecules will sort of get highly expressed here in the middle and start exerting forces. And you'll see that they'll accumulate further and further here, and then eventually cause enough forces for the tissue to sort of dip into the plane in this direction. This is a healthy embryo. Okay. Now, what these biologists were also able to do is they were able to take an embryo that is not healthy, it's a mutant, and this mutant expresses fewer connections between cells, fewer cadherins. So what we're looking at is what happens when this mutant that presumably still has the same number of myosins has less connectivity between cells. Instead of contracting uniformly, it breaks up into clusters. And you know, of course, this is just one movie. I definitely am not going to start claiming that this is critically connected or anything, but at least I see that it breaks up into clusters of, you know, 2 cells, 5 cells, 1 cell, and so on. Yes?
Is there any internalization of the cells in this mutant?
What do you mean? Oh, so you mean this proper folding into a mesoderm? No. Actually, this guy dies.
Okay, but it might be able to internalize some cells before dying. But you're saying nothing.
I don't. So
mutant?
If I remember, this is a. It's an E cadherin. It's delta. I forget the name, the terminology in the fly field, but it's a cadherin mutant.
Okay.
Forget the name, but I honestly I don't think that if I play the movie again, I really don't think cells are internalized. I really think that you don't even have a tissue anymore to start internalizing, as far as I'm. If you compare these two movies, I think this internalizes and this just breaks apart. So we suspect that, you know, these off rates, and you know the interplay between, you know, crossing, extending forces over long distances while also unbinding when there's too much force also applies in biology. This is what we think. So the talk's been going on for quite a while. I have a couple of slides of unpublished work that I would be happy to discuss with everyone after this talk. Further details and questions. And we're thinking of modifications to this diagram that, you know, we think there could be lines here, 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 and so on. I definitely want to talk to you guys about this in detail, especially while we're still forming our thoughts on this. So experts in the field, please come to us. We'll definitely be happy to you know, make sense of this complex problem. And I guess as a last little... Okay, I'll just stop here, and thank you all for your attention.
Thank you.